coming up on Weekend America.
After Martin Luther King died, the hardest working man in show business had to work a little harder.
This is no way. We are black. We are black. Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Can't y'all go back down and let's do the show together? We're black. Don't make us all look bad.
The night the Godfather of Soul became a prince for peace. I'm John Moe.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Also this hour, the Middle East isn't always what you'd expect.
It's kind of crazy when you can come over to the desert and ski in the middle of a mall.
A weekend pass to Dubai. And weekend camping trips should be simple, right?
I'm most worried about not being able to make the fire, not being able to cook the hot dogs, not being able to put up the tent.
And so other words, you're afraid that we're not going to be able to do anything.
Would a roasted marshmallow make it better? Coming up in Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From St. Paul, it's Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe, in for Bill Radke. We hope you're getting a chance to unwind a little this weekend. Take it easy. Of course, sometimes relaxing is easier said than done. Later this hour, we tag along for a highly neurotic camping trip, and we accompany some members of the U.S. Navy taking time off in Dubai as they walk the sometimes thin line between liberty and civility. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend, I have so many things to do, I can't believe it. I have to go to a Bible class. I have to go to a lecture.
I'm probably going to go to a friend's house or go to a movie.
My niece is coming down from Boston, and she's staying for a couple of days, and we're going out to Long Island.
I have two birthday parties to go to, one for a 6-year-old and one for a 26-year-old.
This weekend, I'm waiting for the baby to come. I'm 39 weeks pregnant.
This weekend, I am going to be helping my mom shoveling mulch.
Oh, I like that young man. Shoveling mulch. Send him to my house.
You got some mulch that needs to be shoveled?
Always.
There's always mulch to be shoveled. Those voices came from the mulch-rich cities of Brooklyn, San Francisco, and Las Vegas.
Well, this weekend, many of you may be attending a concert. Now, that's typically not a political act, but it almost turned into one for concertgoers about 40 years ago. On April 5th, 1968, the country was reeling from the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. the night before. Riots had broken out in several cities, and many more were on the brink of chaos. James Brown was scheduled to play at the sold-out 14,000-seat Boston Garden. It was a potential flashpoint right there in the heart of downtown. Weekend America's Michael May takes a look back at that tense day in Boston.
Music journalist Tom Vickers was one of the few white people with a ticket to the James Brown concert that night. He was 18 years old at the time. He grew up in Boston and was a huge fan of R&B. He was well aware of just how much tension there was between whites and blacks in the city. For the most part, whites stayed in South Boston, and blacks stayed in a neighborhood called Roxbury.
If you were a black person and you were found on the streets of South Boston, day or night, you know, you were lucky to escape alive. And quite frankly, the inverse was true. If you were a white person walking the streets of Roxbury, there was danger. You know, you could feel it. It was palpable.
The tension had been escalating in the mid-60s as the city began to desegregate its public schools. The mayoral race in 1967 pitted a liberal reformer, Kevin White, against Louise Day Hicks, an opponent of desegregation. Hicks ran under the evasive slogan, "You know where I stand." White won the race by less than 12,000 votes. So Boston's race relations were already on a short fuse when Martin Luther King was shot and killed on April 4, 1968. John Jabbo Starks, the drummer in James Brown's band, was heading into town to play the Boston Gardens when he heard the news.
That was such a tragedy. It was sad, and then it was shameful. It was like almost like as if you were drained. We're trying to better ourselves, and then this happens.
Riots broke out across the country, and some feared Boston would be next. Tom Vickers remembered there was some rioting in Roxbury Friday night that was quickly stopped.
Yet there was this ongoing fear that there would be mass rioting in Boston, that, you know, the African-American community would spread into these various communities in Boston and just tear up the place.
In fact, city leaders were terrified that the James Brown concert would bring the violence right into the heart of downtown. Mayor Kevin White and Boston's first black city council member, Thomas Atkins, debated whether or not to cancel the concert. They talked about the decision in a VH1 documentary. Mayor Kevin White speaks first.
His concert, we thought, might bring as many as 15 or 20,000 black people from the community, particularly young people, into the city. It just had too much emotion in it not to decide whether that would be a problem.
And I said, Kevin, you are doing exactly the wrong thing. If the word gets out in the black community that the city would not let James Brown come to town and perform in the wake of King's assassination, I said, all hell will break loose.
The city had only a few hours to find a compromise. Meanwhile, Tom Vickers went to a somber memorial for Dr. King that afternoon in Government Center near downtown. Afterwards, he went to the Boston Gardens and asked a large Irish policeman if the show was still going to happen.
And he said, yeah, it's going to happen, but if I were you, I'd just turn in your tickets and get a refund. And I said, well, if the show's going to happen, why would I want to do that? And he said, well, it could be a little edgy here tonight, and here's the good news. They're going to show the concert tonight on WGBH. They're going to broadcast the entire show.
The mayor held a press conference to encourage people to stay home and watch it in the safety of their living room. Vickers cashed in his tickets at the box office, as did thousands of others.
Give another round of applause for James Brown.
That night, around 9 p.m., James Brown walked on stage at the Boston Gardens, and Mayor White was by his side. White addressed the crowd of around 2,000 and the row of television cameras.
Now I'm here tonight, like all of you, to listen to James. But I'm also here to ask for your help. I'm here to ask you to stay with me as your mayor and to make Dr. King's dreams a reality in Boston. This is our city, and its future is in our hands. Tonight, tomorrow, and the days that follow. So all I ask you tonight is this. Well, let us look at each other, here in the gardens and back at home, and pledge that no matter what any other community might do, we in Boston will honor Dr. King in peace. Thank you.
And with that, James Brown, dressed in all black, grabs the microphone and takes over.
I want you to know.
Ain't no sin, because I'm acting with my friends. My friends. My friends. To do it all over again. But that's life.
Jabbo Starks was on the drums. He said as soon as he dug into the groove, the intense sadness he was feeling just lifted.
I love to play. Any problems, anything that I've had is vented because I don't hear, see, or think of anything else except I'm playing that music. It's a relief for me.
Tom Vickers and his family crowded around the TV set in their living room and watched in amazement.
James Brown always gave everything, but at this show, there was an emotional edge to it, and he just seemed totally present in the moment, on fire, and giving 110%.
Help me now. Baby.
Then, just as James Brown dons his golden cape, a young man jumps on stage, and in an instant, a white police officer rushes in and throws the man back into the audience.
Wait a minute.
It looks like the beginning of a riot that the entire city of Boston will witness on TV.
When they came on stage, they was just, I think they were just venting that anger or something out, and they just wanted to, get up and be close to him or get close to however the mind was going. I can't say, but I know that when the police started trying to throw him off stage, that's when it became a little touchy there.
Brown tells the police officers to let him handle it, and he shakes hands with another teenager who's jumped on stage. Suddenly, fans swarm the singer.
It was almost to a point that it was getting ready to be something really bad to happen.
We're black. Don't make us all look bad. Let me finish doing the show.
But when he stopped it, he saw that, he stopped it, and he could do that. He had that kind of power. People would listen to him.
Within a couple of minutes, the Godfather of Soul clears the stage.
Now, I asked the police to step back because I figured I could get some respect for my own people. That makes sense. And are we together, we? Get the thing, man.
That night, there was rioting in over 100 U.S. cities. Dozens of people were killed. Huge areas of Newark, Detroit, and Washington, D.C. went up in flames. But Boston remained quiet. People stayed inside their homes, captivated by the James Brown Show. I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
There's extended video of that night in Boston at our website, weekendamerica.org. It's from the VH1 documentary, The Night James Brown Saved Boston. You know, he was such a colorful and complicated person. I had no idea that he was an activist as well.
Well, so many people think of James Brown as, you know, the sex machine, get on up, or I feel good, but there was so much more to him.
Yeah, in 1966, he had a song, Don't Be a Dropout, urging kids to stay in school, and he did a lot of benefits for black organizations. He raised money for food for poor children.
I saw James Brown on the Seattle waterfront in the early 90s, and it was one of these big, like, outdoor concerts. Uh-huh. Everybody play I Feel Good, and he would deliver these extemporaneous social issues speeches, and everybody would be like, "What? No, get back to the song." It's kind of too bad. This is Week in America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Having some time off can be pretty different when you're part of the American military and you're in the Middle East and you're hanging out at the Hard Rock Cafe. Coming up on Week in America. It's Week in America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe, along with Desiree Cooper. Many Americans are not actually in America this weekend, talking about servicemen and women stationed overseas, many in the Middle East, where the presence of the American military is a complex and volatile issue. Osama bin Laden, insurgents in Iraq, they all cite American troops on Arab soil as a reason for their attacks. We've been bringing you a series of stories called Weekend Pass, stories about our troops and what they do on their downtime. In this installment, we go to the booming city of Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. That's where U.S. warships stop every month or so to rest and refuel. But as reporter Kelly McEvers tells us, time off can be complicated when you're an American serviceman in the Middle East.
People who've lived in Dubai a long time say they can tell a U.S. soldier from a mile away. Short hair, backpack, always travels in threes. These days, though, you don't see so many buzz cuts. That's at least partly because a few months ago, some Marines on leave in Dubai got into big trouble.
What I heard was that they were in a taxi, very drunk, and they were making some kind of obscene gestures to a lady that was driving a car. This lady got offended, called the police, and they got pulled over and thrown into jail.
The Marines didn't know this at the time, but the lady in the car was a member of Dubai's royal family. The person telling this story at an outdoor cafe in Dubai is Claire Kelly, an Australian who's been based here for years. I later confirmed the story with Navy officers.
And after that incident, there was no shore leave for quite some time for any ship that came through.
Even when the soldiers don't have shore leave, Claire still gets to hang out with them. She's the lead singer of a cover band that performs for thousands of troops on huge Navy warships.
You've just got complete view, standing up high on the stage of the boat, completely laden with aircrafts, the sun setting in the background, and people having fun, you know.
The commanders won't let reporters come to port, and they wouldn't comment for this story. One volunteer told me they don't want to bring attention to the fact that thousands of Americans are docking in Dubai every month. So I had to try and catch the sailors around town. They've only recently been allowed to leave port again. Their first stop was Dubai's main marble and chandelier decorated mall and its new indoor ski slope.
Did you ski or snowboard?
Yeah, I snowboarded. Fell a lot of times.
Yeah, he got soaking wet. I stayed pretty dry.
It was definitely fun, though. It's kind of crazy when you can come over to the desert and ski in the middle of a mall.
In the Navy, you don't say R&R. You say liberty. And your commanding officers make sure you know exactly what kind of liberty you have.
Liberty with a purpose. That's what they say. Liberty with a purpose.
What does that mean?
That means that we're here to show that, you know, we have fun, but we're also responsible. We don't do anything stupid and get ourselves in trouble.
Since the Marines got into trouble with the royal family, sailors have been told to be on their very best behavior in Dubai, says this Navy firefighter.
We can't walk around in, like, the spaghetti strap tank tops and halter tops or, like, mini skirts or Daisy Duke shorts.
Yeah, we just got shorts liberty this port. Before that, we had to be pants all the time.
They call it shorts liberty? That means the guys don't have to wear long pants. But most of them are wearing long pants anyway. Down the road, at a bar next to the beach, I meet some guys from Louisiana and Texas who aren't necessarily on their best behavior. They're trying to do, well, more what you'd expect sailors to do with a little liberty.
I mean, we got to get loose. Out to sea, work very hard, and we pull in, you got to get loose. So this is the place to do it.
Yeah, like what kind of loose are we talking about?
Loose however you want. They got all types of loose. I'm not going to get into that, but everybody knows what I'm talking about. You can get loose however you want to out here.
Is it pretty expensive?
Not really. I mean, you can. It's pretty much negotiable.
We get into a taxi to a hotel in the red light district.
Capital Hotel. Just follow this way.
Capital Hotel?
Yeah.
But there's a problem. It's rush hour in Dubai.
I say it's traffic now. You need more than 2 hours to Capital.
The sailors decide to abort the mission. It turns out they don't want to miss curfew. They decide to just head back to port instead, on their best behavior, after all. These sailors all serve on the USS Harry Truman, an aircraft carrier based out of Norfolk, Virginia, that patrols the Persian Gulf. As they say, they're keeping an eye on Iran. So when they get a few days off, they mainly want to relax after long hours of work on the boat. And the place to do that is one that feels familiar, the Hard Rock Cafe, Dubai. Little do the soldiers know, the Hard Rock is owned by a member of the Bin Laden family.
On the count of three, one, two,
the Australian three. Singer, Claire, and her cover band headline the Hard Rock every night. Claire knows these Americans in civilian clothes are sailors, but she's vague about it on stage.
How many people here are from the States? No! This next song is just for you guys.
The Hard Rock is packed with Filipino waitresses, British tourists, and Indian expats who live here in Dubai. It seems like every other table has a plate of whipped cream sitting in front of a kid who's celebrating a birthday. I meet up with the snowboarders, Brad from Baltimore and Chris from Philly. They maintain guns and bombs on planes. Chris says he feels like he's learning something here in the UAE.
Once you hear the name Middle East, automatically anybody thinks in their mind that the Middle East, they get guns and wars and suicide bombings and everything. And then you come to some place like the UAE and it's like, wow, everything's not like this. Everybody that dresses like that is not like that.
This night, there aren't many Arabs at the Hard Rock. But Chris and Brad say they saw tons of Arabs in traditional dress at the mall. And earlier in the day, they volunteered with disabled Arab kids. But after beers, Long Island iced teas, and drinks called car bombs, liberty with a purpose starts to wear off, and things get a little dark. One gal admits she was terrified when she saw women in the mall who covered their faces. Another guy gets in a really nasty fight with his girlfriend outside. His friend starts hitting on everyone in sight.
Will you marry me?
Then a Green Day medley comes on. This makes Brad think about his gal back home.
She met some other guy. I guess, you know, there's a grocery store called Food Lion. Yeah. I guess he makes more money than I do.
And Food Lion.
Yeah, Food Lion. Me and her were together for 4 years. They've been together for a month. And they're already engaged.
I just got told it's last call for the bus. Last call for the bus for our mates from the States.
Claire's not supposed to say who the bus is for, but by now, everyone in the Hard Rock knows it's there to shuttle drunk soldiers back to port. One table of German tourists actually cheers when they hear the sailors are leaving. Brad and Chris decide they'll stay for a while and take a taxi back later. Just a few more songs, they say. Okay, so maybe the band doesn't sound that great. But that's not what matters, they tell me. What matters is that they sound just like home. In Dubai, I'm Kelly McEvers for Weekend America.
To hear more from our Weekend Pass series, go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
One man pitches a fit while his daughter pitches the tent. Fear and Loathing of Camping, coming up on Weekend America.
This is Weekend America, the show that wants to know what you're doing this weekend. And at the moment, Des, we mean that in a musical sense. Des, let me ask you then, what is on your playlist this weekend?
You know, I'm spending all my time just avoiding that Lollipop song by Lil Wayne. It creeps me out and I hear it everywhere.
Here's how uncool I am. I don't know what the song is yet. I'm sure I will, but please.
Let me know when you hear it.
Because we're friends, don't sing it to me. Well, how about you? What song powers your weekends? What is your weekend soundtrack? We've met a lot of listeners, and they've been sharing their songs and their stories. Maureen McNulty Saxton listens to us in Holt, Michigan. She told Weekend America's Bill Radke that her weekend soundtrack is from the musical Oklahoma. Okay?
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day.
Maureen?
Yeah?
Why is this song the soundtrack to your weekend?
Well, my mom basically expected our house to be cleaned on Saturday. And I think being a mother of 8 children, you know, one day of the week, this house was going to get in order. And that was our Saturdays. I mean, we were not allowed to do anything until the house was cleaned.
How did the music go along with the cleaning?
A couple of us kind of got involved, especially my sister Colleen. She got involved in a lot of plays, so a lot of our Saturday chores also were driven around what play Colleen was in that year.
What a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day.
Oklahoma, that particularly spoke to Saturday to me, because when I watched the movie, it starts with Curly riding through the cornfield and singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning." And I guess even like from the earliest days that I saw that movie and then saw the play, to me it was like, oh, that's Saturday morning because there's a dance that night.
Oh, yeah.
Visit, don't miss a tree, and old weeping willow is laughing at me. Oh, what a beautiful morning.
So when you hear this music today, do you smell the Lemon Pledge and the Ajax?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. yeah, I smell that, but I also kind of think of the great feeling of Saturday night. Saturday night was the one time where the house was kind of serene and calm, and my mom usually, while we were cleaning, a tradition for her was she made lasagna for us, and she always made bread. We only grew up on fresh bread, so it was, and on Saturday it would be garlic. I mean, she would make it garlic. So we had this great smell of lasagna, garlic bread, and Mr. Clean. It would be really nice. I miss it.
I've never heard those three lumped together before.
Yeah, it's the original aromatherapy.
When I take you out tonight with me, honey, here's the way it's going to be. You will sit behind a team of snow-white horses in the slickest gig you ever see.
How do you listen to this music now?
I love it so much. I actually have it in the car. My daughter knows. She's been listening to Oklahoma for years now. We go to everything from high school to big-name productions, but to me, it just reeks of family. You know, it's all about family. And so I want, you know, my kids to enjoy it as much as I do.
The wheels are yellow, the upholstery's brown.
Maureen, thank you so much for sharing your weekend soundtrack with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
You can roll right down in case there's a change in the weather. Two bright side lights winking.
I'm annoying Des by singing along in the studio. Maureen McNulty Saxton from Holt, Michigan, with Weekend America's Bill Radke. Go to weekendamerica.org for our whole collection of weekend soundtracks. It's very diverse. It's highly eclectic. And while you're there, share your own. Tell us the story behind it. Weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with John Moe. We're both coming to you from St. Paul. Now, weekends are for many vacations, even if that means a low-tech overnighter in the woods. Jonathan Goldstein was raised to think of the natural world as something he should avoid at all costs. For him, woods just mean trouble. Meanwhile, his daughter, Arizona, has a healthy love of the wild. And when she asked her dad to take her camping, well, that two-word Boy Scout motto became Jonathan's call to arms: be prepared.
Okay, let's go through some of the things that you have here.
We have the flashlight. I have two books. We have a hammer to set up the tent. I have my overnight bag, like my toothbrush and all that. I have a pair of tights in case...
What you're hearing is not the sound of a man and his daughter stalking a fallout shelter.
My fluffy socks and a camera.
Arizona and I are merely going camping.
Yeah, I don't know that there's enough room.
Oh, there'll be enough room.
Arizona is my 11-year-old.
Don't worry.
And we're in the midst of preparing for a night in the wilderness. Or at least a campsite adjacent to the wilderness.
We have one Tropicana orange juice with calcium.
That's right, one single night.
We have Nutella.
I was raised with a high regard for preparedness. Just in case is how my family and I punctuate a great many of our sentences. Preparedness is a value that I try to pass on to Arizona.
Hey, Arizona, did you put the knife in there for the bagels? Cream cheese in there?
On the other hand, a value that I will have a harder time passing on to Arizona...
It would be cool if we saw a wolf, but...
...is a love of nature.
I could live without seeing a wolf.
Nature was always just something for other people, other families. Growing up, we didn't even have real plants in the house, always favoring the plastic kind. Watering, picking up dead leaves, strictly for suckers. But Arizona's a different story.
The crow's my favorite animal.
She loves the outdoors. She gets nature.
Rabbits are cute.
And lately, she's been wanting to go camping.
Oh, we should bring some campfire songs.
So being the nice guy that I am, I agreed to take her.
Let me just take a look at the instructions.
But it wasn't going to be like some personal essay in Field & Stream magazine.
And away we go. We're off. What are you most nervous about with the trip?
Is that the fire's not going to light? What are you most worried about?
Yeah, I'm most worried about not being able to make the fire, not being able to cook the hot dogs, not being able to put up the tent. And
so, in other words, you're afraid that we're not going to be able to do anything. Is that it?
Pretty much. I was a basket case.
How many times have you gone camping before?
Twice.
When I was a kid, I was instructed to never pick up anything I found on the ground. Coins, bus tickets, nothing. Because in the words of my mother, someone could have peed on it.
Is that an entrance to something?
While Arizona was imagining trees and wildlife, all I was imagining was one big urinal.
All right, here we are, pulling into Oka Park Campground.
Yep.
Boy, we're right in the thick of it, eh?
Yeah.
It's beautiful. All the trees.
What number are we?
Wildlife, nature, shrubs, greenery, leaves.
To all the world, I was a dad taking his daughter on a routine camping trip.
Home sweet home.
We are here, folks.
Oh, look, we got a picnic bench.
Let's just not take anything else out until we have our tent ready, okay?
Arizona sounded like she really knew what she was talking about.
Don't put that here.
And since it's in my nature to respect authority...
Put them up like that?
I found myself letting her take charge of the operation.
So tent first? That's what you're saying?
Tent first.
All right, okay, fine.
Although I couldn't help but offer some suggestions.
Take some thought where you want to put it.
Right here.
Oh, no, not on the dirt. Listen to what I just said. Oh, man. Okay, step one, unpack the tent bag and separate the contents. Assemble the shock corded frame.
Keep going. Okay, wait, calm down. Okay, wait, keep going.
I'm lost.
Keep going. It's going to have to turn at one point.
Who are you? Where do you... Is this step four?
I have no idea, but it's one of the steps.
You know, I never got to do any of this kind of stuff with my dad.
Arizona tends to block me out when I go into sentimental old man mode, talking about my dad and stuff like that.
There is a black squirrel in the middle of eating a pine cone. Well, a pine cone.
But as for the natural world, my father always maintained that he liked nature. But what he really meant was that he liked watching nature. Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, to be exact. That was pretty much how he liked his wild, neatly framed by a 21-inch TV screen. In that way, he was king of the Wild Kingdom.
Man, okay, this is way further than I ever thought we'd be able to get, frankly.
I've been carrying around with me all day a palpable terror that because of my own incompetence, Arizona and I could end up sleeping under a picnic table, balled up like hedgehogs.
I just, like, break up some twigs now.
Do we need something to, like, poke around with?
I set the newspaper on fire, and I put a match right on top of the pine needles.
I know this sounds crazy.
Careful, careful.
But I just felt so relieved on such a primordial level that we had a fire.
It's amazing we might end up eating hot dogs for dinner.
That my kid was being fed. That we had shelter for the evening.
Mm.
I actually felt high.
That is really good. Okay, stop licking your arm. You got bug spray on it. Oh, my God. Okay, hang on. How is it?
Good.
Normally, eating hot dogs makes me feel guilty. But eating a hot dog in the great outdoors felt necessary. Like an imperative. A necessity for survival.
Man, this is well earned, huh?
Uh-huh.
Isn't this the life? There's nothing like a meal that you made yourself in the outdoors, huh?
Mm-hmm.
We've accomplished all of our goals. Tent, fire, hot dogs.
Our fire's out.
Okay, maybe I was getting a little cocky. But it was time to get some shut-eye anyhow. And having the fire go out saved me the job of having to pour out our bottled water supply to extinguish it. This was something I was starting to learn in the wild. You had to roll with things. That's how the animal kingdom did it. A beaver comes home to find his dam destroyed. Time to get some shut-eye. A falcon comes home and finds his nest has been robbed of its eggs. Time to get some shut-eye.
I think you're supposed to take your shoes off before you go in. Just not to track mud in and stuff like that.
There's already dirt in it, so I don't
know. No, there's no dirt in it.
Yeah, well, what's that?
I knew this for a fact because I'd plucked up every little twig and each bit of dirt from inside the tent like a human dustbuster.
Oh, this is the life. This is the only life for me. It's the only life I've ever really known.
You could never go 6 days probably 7 days without watching TV.
Do you think that's what would be hardest for me, sleeping in a tent for 7 days would just be the lack of TV? You think if they threw a TV into the sleeping bag, then I'd be fine? It's untight.
No. Oh, this is really soft toilet paper.
It's a little touch of civilization, huh? Makes you lonesome for home? How many days do you think you could stay out here?
I don't know.
I could probably stay out here, you know, another day and a half or so.
Do you think if you've lived in the outdoors your whole life, you could find your own food?
You mean without, like, going to the grocery store?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. You think?
Uh-uh.
Go through people's trash?
Well, I feel like Indians. If you went back in the past, you'd think you could do it.
Oh. What do you think?
No.
We were talking, exchanging ideas. Well, at least we were getting a chance to just hang out, doing something real together.
In case I fall asleep, all right? You're in charge, okay?
Living instead of just watching people living on TV. And that's what I was enjoying the most.
Okay, but if you fall asleep, I wake you up.
Okay, but good night.
For me, the pleasure of going camping has been equal parts what's in the woods, alongside of what isn't. The ringing phones, the sound of traffic, the obligation of constant emails. And once you get rid of all that stuff, what you're left with is just being, spending time. And I love spending time with Arizona.
Wow, it is so dark. Okay, let's step outside. We gotta take a look at the sky. Come on.
There won't be that many stars out. They come out around like 11 or 10.
Is that true? I thought they come out like when it's dark, and it's so dark. Man, I'm gonna want to come back here. I like it here. You?
Maybe next time with veggie dogs instead of the regular kind. We would have to do it again. I meant it.
With.
At least until the next morning, as we were packing up the tent.
The side long leg's lost. It's his front small leg, his back big leg.
What do you think he's missing? A leg? No, 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 you don't.
He only has six legs.
Okay, but don't. I think he could bite you, though.
He won't bite me. It's a daddy long legs.
Yeah, but don't they bite?
No.
You really care about the wild, eh? You're a friend to man and beast alike, right down to the last daddy long legs.
Move. I gotta pick it up.
That was Jonathan Goldstein and his daughter, Arizona. This piece is part of a public radio series called Stories of the Heart of the Land, produced by Jay Allison and Emily Botine. There's a link to the series at our website, weekendamerica.org.
It does. I have to say that I really related to both Jonathan and his daughter in that story. Jonathan's apprehension about the story, and then Arizona's just blind faith that everything was going to be okay. I think camping as a kid and camping as a grown-up are just, they're in different universes. Mm-hmm. They're different realities.
What, like, are you worried about your kid as an adult, or what
well,
makes it
because I went camping all the time when I was a kid. We'd go for weeks at a time up to the San Juan Islands, mm-hmm. which is off the coast of Washington State, up there by Canada. And it seemed like the simplest thing in the world. You know, you'd go up there.
From a kid's perspective.
Exactly. You'd swim, you'd maybe ride your bike, you'd play. And then only when I became an adult did I realize all the work that my parents had done to meticulously craft this seemingly simple thing. And now I look at, you know, camping as an adult, especially in this modern age where, you know, you need to prepare your kids mm-hmm. for all sorts of things. And I just think, let's go to it like a cabin. That'll be good. Or a lodge of some sort. I don't want to go camping anymore. But,
well, camping really is a lot of work to make it simple.
Yes.
But we used to go camping with a couple other families. And no lie, we were like the poor family, like in the little tent. This family had like a kitchen tent. Their actual tent had rooms in it. And they had a plug-in refrigerator. I am not kidding you.
Camping. They brought an apartment.
Exactly.
But I think it's true what Jonathan says, too. You know, it's ultimately about being with other people, being with people you love, being with friends or family.
And you focus on each other
yeah.
in a way that you can't in your real life.
And your refrigerator.
And your refrigerator.
You're listening to Week in America.
Moving across the country can be tricky. You've got to move the couch, the table, the cars. And then there's that trunk of memories. And that just might be the heaviest thing in the house. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
This is Weekend America. I'm John Moe with Desiree Cooper. If you're feeling ambitious this weekend, maybe you want to take on a big project, something like, you know, tackling all that junk in the basement or cleaning out the garage. Now, that's what I had to do not too long ago in a major way. I was moving from Seattle to St. Paul, Minnesota, and that meant going through everything I owned and deciding what to keep and what to throw out. And some things were harder than others. I have this box down in the basement. and it's The Box. I'm sure you have one just like it, full of letters, photos, journal entries, term papers, birthday cards. Mine's a big Rubbermaid tote, 30-gallon size, pretty much me as told in paper from early childhood to about age 24. It must weigh 80 pounds, and I never open it. I never look at it. It's not like framed artwork or photo albums. I never get an urge to go down to the basement and read a birthday card from my mom from 1992. But moving means sorting through everything. Now, some of the stuff inside is quite lovely. A picture of me at 21 working at a summer camp. I'm happy, tan, hopeful, strutting toward the future. A lot of what's in here belongs in the why in the world did I keep this file? An envelope of hair from the barber visit that ended my hippie period. And this, Dear John, Ben would not be who he is if it weren't for you. Thank you for your dedication. Much love, Chris. Who's Ben? Who's Chris? Then there's the hard stuff. A postcard from my brother in 1987. He says he's sorry he didn't get to say goodbye before he left. I don't know what he's referring to. It was written 20 years before he died, suddenly. There are angry letters from friends I treated badly, telling me how much I hurt them. I saved them all, locked them away. I never read them. That can't be healthy, can it? Also in the box, stuff so horrible, it's funny. This in a note from a very ex-girlfriend. Your problem is you're way too needy, John, and it's not just me who feels that way. I've talked to people we both know, and we all agree that you're needy. Maybe I should call and see if she likes me any better now. There's a world of stuff in here, and after spending some time with it, I want to set it on fire. All of it. Oh, how can you say that? That's your past. Those are memories. That box is who you are. No, that box is who I was. Like when I was 10, I was a huge football fan. Football defined me, and I hoarded football trading cards. To this day, I have this one card, Chris Barr, kicker, Cincinnati Bengals. I reached Barr at his home in Bullsburg, Pennsylvania, and I asked him if I should keep the card.
Should you keep it? For what reason?
Well, because I've always kept it. I've had it since 1978.
Then I'd hang on to your cards.
Do you have that card of yourself?
Yes, I do. I have them all, actually, somewhere along the way. I know I have a helmet, a jersey. You know, I've moved, and they get into boxes and never go anywhere. Like I said, I've never really put anything out.
Maybe he should put it out. It's paper, dead trees. My box is dead weight, a corpse of memories that I have to ship or load onto a truck and then haul into my new basement in my new city where it will spend even more years never being looked at. I'd rather destroy it. The things that mattered are already memories. This is excess baggage. And I'm moving. I'm trying to start anew. The new me waking up in the new city wouldn't have to bear this weight. Thing is, I can't bring myself to do it. The stuff has a hold on me. Wanna chuck it? Can't. I'm held captive by ghosts. Eric Larson is in my box. He was the editor of my high school newspaper. I have numerous editions. They feature the worst writing I've ever done, and they trigger agonizing high school flashbacks. Eric was a journalism star in high school. Not long after graduating, he started selling insurance.
Oh my goodness! I'm almost ashamed or embarrassed to admit I've probably got at least a couple of dozen. I probably have every issue. They're in some of these Rubbermaid containers in the garage, neatly or cleverly or subconsciously positioned next to my wine cabinets, refrigerators. So as I go out occasionally on the weekend to grab a nice bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon or what have you to bring in a decant, I'll see the box there, and I will from time to time take a stroll down memory lane.
Eric's made peace with his box. He's made peace with himself. I guess I'm a little different than that. I don't wish to give up the people I love and the memories I cherish, but I'm willing to sacrifice all the papers, the evidence, the reminders, the senior prom tickets, the better-than-expected report card, the desperate resume from a period of total unemployment in order to achieve a kind of psychic lightness. I talk to lots of people, from my box. Every one of them has a box of their own, or several. Some of them had entire storage lockers of boxes, and they spend hundreds of dollars a year to store them. Everyone wishes they could throw stuff out. No one has. But one night, after a long, emotionally exhausting session, sifting through my box with the pressure of moving day weighing on me, I found my nerve. I carried the box to the carport, placing it next to the garbage cans to await the garbage truck. I have never felt so free. I could move to St. Paul and be only who I wanted to be, not who I used to be. But before the garbage truck came, I went out to the carport, picked up the box, and carried it back in. And when the moving truck to St. Paul came, I put the stupid box on board. In Seattle, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Okay, John, I passed by your desk today, and I thought I saw that box. Now, you are here in St. Paul now. You've made the move. What's happened to the box?
Well, you know, wouldn't it be great if I could sit here, Des, and tell you that it's all been carefully archived or that it's all been incinerated, but it's just, it's in the basement. It's in the new basement. It's sitting in the new basement. We've posted some of the weirder items from my box at our website, pictures of people I don't remember, notes from people who I have no idea what they're talking about. Help solve the puzzle. WeekendAmerica.org.
And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. The show is produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Jim Gates, Millie Jefferson, E. Okobi, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Tim Bomba, and Angela Kim.
Also Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, Christina Pena, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, David Banks, Phyllis Owens, and Mark Sanchez.
Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. Get a free podcast of today's program at weekendamerica.org. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe. Remember, it's your weekend. Enjoy it.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is Desiree Cooper, co-host of Weekend America. This weekend in 1968, America sang along.
Nixon's the only one. We believe in Nixon.
All this year, we're looking back at This Weekend in 1968 and why it still matters today. Join us on Weekend America.